Hey, my name is Jim Higgins. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Jim.
And, you know, it's always an honor to be asked to come and share. I'll try to keep the volume up because I know that's a tendency I have is to talk quietly, and, you know, which some people find to be a blessing for me. But, yeah. I've known quite a few eloquent speakers in AA, and I'm not one of them, so I'll give you the warning up front. You know, I was thinking, you know, when someone asks you to speak, or at least when they ask me to speak, I go back and think about what I should talk about and what my life's been like. My life today is remarkable. And when I came into the program, the day I came in the last time, I was going to kill myself that day, you know, pretty horrible fashion. I was going to dump a can of gasoline on myself and set it on fire. Either that or get sober. And I obviously opted for the sober thing. But it was a tough choice at that time because I had hit this emotional and spiritual bottom. I'd been in a lot worse physical situations and things like that before. I didn't have any impending jail. I wasn't just arrested or anything. But I just could not stand the thing of waking up one more day saying, I'm not going to do this, and having to do it. Because alcohol, and in my case, you know, drugs, just owned me. And I had to, I yet had to either change or I couldn't live like this anymore. And my life today is remarkable. When I was trying to review this and think about, okay, well, you know, what should I talk? I think every time I tell my story, it's different. You know, I think of the different things. I mean, it's the stuff happened the same, but there's so much that has happened in my life. If I were to review my life from one perspective and not talk about the alcoholism, I've had a very successful life. I mean, I could look at my work resume and stuff like that and say, wow, you know, everything was just great. On the other hand, if I just look at the other stuff, you know, my ism and my, you know, where my addictions and stuff took me, I mean, it was awful. You know, it was just awful. And, you know, I started when I was 14 years old is when I picked up my first drink. And I knew what AA was. My dad was in AA. My dad came in AA the day I was born, literally, because my mother made him. He lived to be in his 70s, but he had like six brothers that had died from alcoholism before they hit 40. And even though my dad did not stay sober all those years, you know, he had a couple years sober and he'd go out for a little while or run amok and you know, he repeated that several times. But, you know, he managed to have a pretty productive life. And, you know, I'm sure it's, you know, just the result of this program. But when I finally got to the point where I was, you know, ready to start looking at the program or when people were telling me that I should, you know, I always said, well, you know, I'm not really an alcoholic or I'm not a bad one. You know, I'm not a bad alcoholic. And, you know, it was just a different thing. So being exposed to the program when you're young, you know, didn't necessarily mean anything. I'd been in my first AA meeting when I was 6 years old because he took me. And I was a little kid, I was 10 or 12 or something, I think, is when I met Sister Ignatia because I was born in Cleveland and brought up there. So just, you know, weird stuff looking back on it. But, you know, it had no impact on me at the time until I finally came in here and actually, you know, started paying attention. And I did not get sober on my first entry in AA. It did not happen like that. I had to go back out a couple times. And although it says in a big book, half measure availeth nothing, my first exposure to AA, I came in 1974 on a marijuana maintenance plan. I had been dealing pot, and so I kept a pound of pot and said, I'm not. But I did quit doing heroin and drinking alcohol. And I did that for 9 months, which if I hadn't done that, I'm sure I would not have lasted the 9 months. I would have died back then. you know, but after that, I went back to the same old stuff, you know, after 9 months. You know, I look back on it and say, well, you know, because at the time my rationale was, you know, pot never really did anything bad for me. This other stuff was bad, but, you know, that wasn't so bad. But the deal is, when I finally got here the last time and started paying attention to what it says in the big book, it says that the purpose of this book, which I believe is the program, is to find a power greater than yourself that will solve your problems. It doesn't say in there that the purpose of this book is to teach you how to quit drinking or how to quit this other stuff. It just says, you know, you got to find a higher power, and this other stuff will take care of itself. And that's pretty much, you know, been my experience here, is when I finally was willing to do that. And I fought that because I, you know, after that thing I talked about in 74, my final sobriety date was July 10th, 1988. But 6 years prior to that, I came in and I stayed sober, I stayed dry for 3 years. And I went out for one day. I had a resentment, so I said, a drink will help this. And I started drinking at 8 o'clock. By noon, I'd almost got shot by a cop, got in a high-speed chase, and got locked up in Pickens County. So I don't do real well, you know, doing that stuff. My wife at the time, the reason I came in that first time was the lady I was married to, we had a son, and he was 1 year old. It was his, as a matter of fact, it was his birthday party. And we were doing a lot of drugs and stuff, and throwing furniture out the windows of the apartment and things. And when the police came, they arrested both of us, you know, for this felony possession kind of stuff. So they took our son away because there was no one there to watch him. And I knew that the only way I was going to be able to stay, get him back, was to talk to a social worker or DFACS. And the only way I was able to do that was to, you know, get sober. I knew I couldn't do it by myself because, you know, I had to have something during the day. So that's why I first came to AA, was to, you know, get by that hurdle. And, you know, after about a week or so of not doing anything, I started realizing, you know, maybe, because I had always, prior to that point, you know, this was my second marriage, and for some stupid reason, I had always thought I was a good parent. You know, I wasn't, but, you know, that's the way I perceived myself until, you know, DFACS stepped in that time. So, you know, that's when I got sober the first time and tried that dry stuff. Like I say, it's 3 years, then I went out for the day, I came back in. And then, after another 3 years, my wife, who's now my ex-wife, you know, she and I both went out at the same time. About the time she came home with her new fiancé, it's the time I decided I probably ought to get sober again. That was after a few weeks. At the time, I was living in Michigan, and I had moved back to, as a result of that, I moved back to Georgia. And that's where I came to that decision that I was either going to kill myself or I was going to get sober. Because I was in a parking lot of Engels on 92 and Bell's Ferry, and, you know, I remember that day real well. And I'm grateful that I do, because, you know, that's when my life began, you know, really. Because, you know, up until that time, I'd been around a program. I could have quoted you all kinds of stuff from the big book. But I had no conscious contact with a higher power, none whatsoever. And, you know, that was what I finally had to start doing. And, you know, I started to look back on my life, you know, and taking inventory and stuff. And there was all kinds of stuff, you know. That I had experienced through life. When I was a little kid, we used to move a lot because, like I said, my dad was an alcoholic and he'd be straight for several years at a time. But basically, we never lived any place longer than 3 years. So he would go out and maybe run amok for a while, and we would move. So I went to lots of different schools. And I was kind of a alien person. I was always detached from everybody else. You know, I could fit in with lots of different groups, but I was just, I was kind of weird because I was this outlaw on one hand, and on the other hand, I was a geeky kind of kid. I got into ham radio when I was 13 and liked that, yet by the same token, when I was 14, I did a burglary, and, you know, I was, you know, so, you know, in seventh grade, my first probation officer. So, you know, my life was not, you know, anything to write home about. But, you know, I managed to kind of get through stuff. But my senior year of high school, I decided I was going to quit school because I had this opportunity to work on race cars. And I did that for a year until I found out that there was a whole lot of other stuff that went with it that was just really obnoxious, you know, sliding under carts with slush dripping down your neck and stuff like that. So I went back to school the next year. So I had two senior years in high school. And when I went back to second year, I was working full-time. And so between drinking and working full-time and going to high school, you know, I was a bit of a mess, but I managed to muddle through and get out of it. And, you know, then my drinking started really going then when I got out and started doing, you know, regular working kind of stuff. And, you know, I was bad. Used to go out all the time. And summer times were, this is in Ohio, were particularly good because the bars, the way it worked was that the laws were written in Eastern Standard Time and daylight saving. Anyways, you had an extra hour to drink, so, you know, I'd be able to stay out until 3:30 in the morning and then go to work, stumble into work the next day. But I managed to do that. I managed to, you know, do really well for a while until I was about 21, and I had some bad relationship, and I drank a little, well, I drank a lot more than usual. I drank about a fifth of liquor, and wrapped my GTO around a telephone pole and almost died. So that was 1966. And, you know, that should have been somewhat of a warning for me. And what I remember about that is when I got out of the hospital and my jaw was wired shut and I'm got this ace bandage around my head. I look like a nun. And I was at a bar with my friends drinking. I had a beer and I'm drinking, and my friend gave me a shot, which is what I usually drank, but I didn't order one. And just the smell of it made me throw up. And don't do that when your jaw's wired shut. Do not do that. But anyways, that was God's way and nature's way of saying, you know, this stuff's bad for you. You know? But I was able to overcome that, you know, after a couple months. I worked my way up, you know, from mixed drinks back to drinking regular drinks. So I could do it. And, you know, it's just kind of kept going on, okay? It just kept going on. I got this really magnificent job offer. I moved to Vermont, and I was up there at IBM Laboratories for about 3 years, and that was, you know, it was a great job. That was probably one of the best jobs I ever had in my life, looking back on it. But, you know, I didn't perceive it that way. And I was decided, you know, I had been wearing three-piece suits and stuff like that, and I decided that I wanted to be a hippie, basically. And that's kind of where I went. And, you know, I started, you know, I started to do the smoking pot and moved into some other things. And, you know, but I said, you know, there's other things I won't do. And anyways, I ended up ODing at work. I took too many codeine sulfate tablets and ODed, tried to cut myself up. And this is a plant where they have 4,000 people, and they took me down. They actually had a doctor that worked there, and he said, "I've never seen anything like this." So I had the distinction of being the first, you know, drug case they ever ran into up there in Vermont. But so they took me down to the Nut House, you know, the local Mary Fletcher Hospital psych ward, and that's where I stayed for maybe a month or so, until this one hippie girl. Now, I was married, okay, and, you know, we just had our second child, and, you know, I'd had two childs, but, I didn't. That was our second child. I was getting into the future later, so this is confusing for me. But, you know, anyways, the girlfriend that I had met down in Burlington, Vermont, helped me escape from the nut house. So we hitchhiked cross country. We were headed for Haight-Ashbury, you know. And I got as far as Denver, and I ended up in a nut house in Denver. So that didn't work real well, you know. And, you know, ultimately I ended up going back to work at IBM. They took me back. All this time I was gone, they were still sending my wife checks, you know, and, you know, even in my absence. But, you know, I concluded after that, after I was going back to work at IBM, I said, you know, this has got to be the problem, isn't it? You know, this company. I mean, I need to have a little more free spirit. So I quit there and moved back to Cleveland, Ohio, of all things. Jeez. That shows a little mark of insanity right there. But that's what I did. I went back there. And I went back with some people I knew from the old days, and I ended up going and getting more involved. You know, this is my story. I go to the bar and all the time, and anyways, I started moving into different drugs and stuff. Had some good friends there that I would party with, you know, and we'd drink and we'd get high, and I remember one thing that we said one time. I said, well, we'll never, ever, ever shoot drugs, you know, so shortly before I ended up moving to Georgia, you know, he hung himself in a jail cell in Cleveland because he'd robbed another drugstore, and he didn't want to go back to Ohio Penitentiary again for, you know, doing it. But that was a thing I was into. I was back there doing that stuff and drinking, and I moved my addictions. You know, in a big book it talks about, hey, we moved from gin to vodka to this to that, and take a vacation, don't take a vacation. And I did that. I mean, I absolutely did that. And I moved to other stuff. And I lots of different things and lots of different injectable things. You know, nowadays, I go to lots of AA meetings. Okay, I get to about 7 meetings a week. And I go to one a week, I go to Cocaine Anonymous, and I go to Heroin Anonymous. And I did not get sober in either one of those places. I got sober in AA. You know, the reason I go to those places is because some people can relate, you know, with that. And, you know, because it's an important thing, you know, for me it was important that they related with my alcoholism. I had a lot of other stuff going on, but the solution's the same. Those two things I go to, they use the same big book. The solution's exactly the same. The only thing different is the format. And, you know, I believe in this singleness of purpose, but what I'm telling now is just my story. And, you know, the deal with me is that I needed people that I could relate to. And I could relate with alcoholics on the alcohol level. When I first got sober, you know, there were some people at the old house place that were junkies just like I was. So I could, you know, we'd talk about that on the side, you know, because there are subtle differences, like, you know, it's a lot easier to die doing that quickly. And anyways, today, you know, I stay committed to the program of AA. I continue to do this on a daily basis. And when I got in, you know, the one thing I had to mention is this was just a little bit of the history thing. But when I came in, you know, I was presented with this thing, you got to find a higher power. And to me, that was a challenge. And I did not want to deal with that, even the last time in. But I said I'd be willing to do anything. And I got a sponsor that was, he was just a real spiritual guru. And he'd had kind of an interesting, he was a very interesting guy. Jimmy Egan was his name. And he would, at one time he was an ex-professional, he's an ex-professional prize fighter, and then when he started drinking, he ended up getting tied up with the mob and spent years and years in prison. And he was in like an Attica prison during the riots. So he had some interesting, you know, stories. And, you know, I couldn't relate with preachers, okay? And, you know, I had to find my higher power the way I had to find my higher power. But here was a guy that found his higher power. And one of the key things that I learned from him was he was very involved with service. That was the thing. And, you know, I've heard that it says in the big book, it says, you know, that the root of our disease is selfishness, self-centeredness. That we think is the root. And that was sure my root cause, you know. I did not think so when I started taking my inventory the first time. I didn't think I was selfish at all. I had no character defects when I first got here, none. You know, I didn't have any fears either. I thought, you know, because I did all this really crazy stuff that, you know, I was fearless. I didn't realize I was just stupid, you know. And, you know, taking the inventory started revealing some of that stuff. And I found out that, and I had lots and lots of anger. And I found out that some of that, most of that was fear. And I found out I had a ton of fear. And I found out I was selfish. And I did not like this. And, you know, I had to kind of go through the process of accepting it. But when I was in step three, because I was asking this guy, Jimmy, he said, you know, how do I get through step three? How do I turn my will and my life over to God? He said, well, you pick up a pencil and you start writing on pen in step four. And that's what I did. You know, I just started the process. Because that's what this is. In a big book, a thing, and I didn't find this right away. As a matter of fact, I don't think I found this my first passes at the program. But that thing way in the back of the book, that appendix, spiritual experience, is huge for me. You know, where it says, you know, a lot of us have the educational variety. Because if I was rocketed into a fourth dimension, it was a real slow rocket, let me tell you. Today in my life, all my days are great. I found that's a decision. I can wake up in the morning and decide what kind of day I'm going to have. I used to be a victim of whatever it was. If the weather was poor, you know, I could have a reason to have a bad day, or if someone didn't do what I wanted. And, you know, most days now, people don't do what I want. And a lot of times the weather's not. But, you know, I can make up my mind in the morning that I'm going to have a good day, and I do. I ask God to remove me of the bondage of self, because I met the enemy and he's me, you know. And this is such a tremendous program, and I dodged it so long because I did not want to get involved with that spiritual stuff, you know. There used to be a guy a long time ago, I went to a hot place, that said talking about the spiritual part of the program is like talking about the wet part of the ocean. You know, this is entirely a spiritual program. It just absolutely is. But I didn't see that. And, you know, the things I didn't do the first times around, I never did any service work. You know, I certainly didn't sponsor anyone because no one was crazy enough to ask me. And, you know, today I try to get involved with doing stuff for other people. It's really weird because I spent my entire life, you know, chasing this happiness. You know, and it was like trying to grasp smoke. You can't do it. But when I don't pay any attention to that, and I start, you know, being concerned with other people, happiness comes, you know. Go figure, you know. this is a whole different way of living, because that was not the way I thought I was supposed to live my life, because I thought it was all based on willpower. And, you know, in some areas of my life, I was very successful from the willpower, but I could, you know, it did not work when it came to the not drinking or the not using. And, You know, back early on, you know, I have people, and I kind of knew this about the not yets, because I had all these not yets. Well, I'll never do this, and I'll never do that, and I'll never do that, you know, and I did a lot of stuff, and, you know, I've seen people die as a result of it. I don't know why I'm not dead today. It's just been a... The big deal in AA a long time ago used to be that expression, there but for the grace of God, and that's what I got. I did mention my second wife, and, you know, when we both went out, and that was coming up on 29 years, she stayed out, you know. And she married that guy after a while, and that didn't last very long. But, she, you know, and then she went, you know, kind of been bouncing in and out. But she's been, you know, still, I don't know how she lived this long. I know my son had to do the Narcan thing with her, you know, about 6 months ago because she was dying. And, you know, she did that twice and ended up going back to jail, you know. It's a little old to be going back to jail, you know. And, you know, because she violated probation. But, you know, I think she's maybe back in the program, maybe working at, you know. But, you know, my son, he's bounced in and out. I'm not sure, how he's doing now. I mean, you know, but he's a junkie too, you know. It's really spooky, you know, this disease, because we can move into different areas, you know. The first HA meeting, Heroin Anonymous meeting I ever went to was in Cleveland, Ohio, and at that time, my ex-wife and he were both, you know, straight and sober, and they took me to a meeting that they were going to when I was up there visiting. And I said, wow, this is really cool. We need something like that down here in Georgia. And we started one at the Extension. You know, but, you know, it's just like AA, you know. You know, we got the rooms here, and people can come in, and we can come to the meetings all we want, but it's our choice whether we're willing to do it and stick with it. And, you know, for too long, I didn't. And step 10, that always comes up, and I always think about that. You know, it's having this daily reprieve. I mean, I don't have to go to 7 meetings a week. I really don't have to, you know, but I do want to now. And, you know, that helps with the daily reprieve, I'm sure, you know. The praying and the phone calls and all that stuff and working with others. And I can relate, you know, with people because... You know, what I'll tell people, no matter what it is, whether it's alcohol or drugs, I haven't done either one for a long, long time, but I'm just as much an addict and just as much an alcoholic as the day I was doing them. And that's the thing I got to remember. And it tells me that in the big book on page 30. It says, hey, we're different from other people, you know. The idea that I'm ever going to be the same, you know, that's kind of got to be smashed. I'm not going to be the same as other people. And, you know, it's funny because at first I used to, it really used to tick me off. It's like, oh, look at all these, you know, they're able to drink and do this and I can't do that. And, you know, I had some people point out to me, well, if you weren't really an alcoholic, you wouldn't care. You know, like, you wouldn't care, like, if you didn't have a Pepsi, you know, you wouldn't get that upset about it, you know. But, no, I mean, it's just the insanity. I didn't know that I had it, because that's the other thing we talk about in step one a lot. We talk about the honesty. And a big deal there for me is the self-honesty. And we talk about that, and in the first step they say, you know, the delusion, they use that word delusion. Now, I may be mistaken, but I think that means if you have delusions, you're kind of crazy, because delusions are where you think that this reality is something other than it is. Like Napoleon, you know, with his steel, that was a delusion. He thought he was Napoleon. And, you know, if people told me, they said, well, you're an alcoholic. No, I'm not, you know. And so, you know, I had these delusions. But it's an ongoing process. Really early on, it says, why did the people relapse? And it says, well, they failed to grow along spiritual lines. So what that tells me is that this is an ongoing process. I have to keep being willing to do that. And stuff does get revealed. There's stuff I read a long time ago, and it just dawns on me what the heck it means, you know? There's this one part in step one, and this is pretty basic. It's a, you know, it talks about the great obsession of an alcoholic, you know, lead him to death, is that we can control and enjoy our drinking. And it dawned on me, I have never ever, since I was 14 years old and picked up my first drink, have been able to do both of those things at the same time. I could either control my drinking or I could enjoy it. I could never control it and enjoy it. You know, and I mean, that was in a book all these years, you know, and I read it many, many times, but it never really dawned on me how basic that is. And to me, that's just a great definition of an alcoholic. And I try to control and enjoy lots of things, and it just, you know, it don't work. So I try to stay teachable, and, you know, some people would say, well, you know, as you go along, you just keep getting dumber and dumber, and I think that's a good thing, you know. And I'm certainly getting good at getting dumber, but, life is good today. I mean, it really is. I remember, you know, in early sobriety, I told you how I was on my first day. And my first year was no picnic, you know. There were times during my first year where I was still suicidal, you know, I would bounce up and down. And, the people in this program saved my life, you know. That's the only way I can say it. They absolutely saved my life. When I was out there, I didn't really care whether I lived or died. Really on some of my first passes, I said, well, if I go out there again, I'll die. And the problem is it wasn't fast enough, you know, just because basically what happened is when I went back out, I lived in misery, just absolute misery, you know, this emotional thing and this spiritual illness. And I'm just so blessed today I don't have that, you know. I get to do this. I get to work with other alcoholics and other addicts. Get to do some things. A different thing is when one of the reasons I like to, I said, we started a, if anyone needs to know about this, by the way, there's a Heroin Anonymous meeting at Howe Place at 8 o'clock on Friday nights. And, you know, what's really neat for me is I go in there and I'm triple the average age. I mean, it's ridiculous, you know, but it's, there's some guys in there, you know, 25 years old, they got 3 years sober. They got 2 years sober. And there's other people that, you know, can relate with that. And, you know, it just amazes me and hearing the honesty. And, you know, you see a lot of people, they come in there and they get it and they're willing to do this stuff and they do it. And then you see some of them go out and they die, you know, and some of them don't. But, you know, without going off on that, it happens in AA, okay? It does. It's a lot slower, painful process usually. But, you know, I've seen that happen a lot, you know. And I've seen it happen to people with lots of years of sobriety, too. Because I know today that time has nothing to do with it. And it might have a little, because, you know, but if I just think I got it made, I don't. The reason it's got a little is I got past the point of an obsession pretty early on. You know, I looked back and said, oh, wow, you know, after a couple months, I didn't have this obsession I used. But I still had this lingering thing in my brain that if something really bad happened, you know, if someone, this person dies or that, you know, that's the only conditions I would ever drink under, or the only conditions I would ever use under. But I always had those, you know, I was saying, I don't have that anymore. Alcohol and drugs have, you know, no value in my life. Because I know that no matter what happens, even if bad stuff like that happens, that would not help. It would only hurt. And it took me a long time to get to that point. After years, you know that kind of kicked in with me, is that there's just no value whatsoever in it. You know, because it was a lurking thing. It wasn't, you know, consciously in my mind, but when things would come up, I think, and that's a lot, you know, a lot of people do that. And I'm just really blessed today that does not, I don't think like that anymore. And I never thought I'd be to that point, you know, but it's, because, you know, my first thing when I first looked at coming in AA was I just visualized all these people sitting around, you know, sitting on their hands and, damn, I can't drink, you know, can't do this, can't do this, can't do that. And it's not like that at all, you know. I learned what, you know, true happiness and joy was all about, and I never had that. I mean, just back in my fairly early drinking days, you know, I'd be out all night partying with people, and they'd talk the next day, and they'd say, man, you know, you had a great time last night. And I'm thinking, they don't know about the part where I went home and stuck a gun in my mouth. They don't know about that, you know. You ain't supposed to know what Hoppy's gun oil tastes like, you know. That's, it's crazy stuff, you know. But that was part of my disease. I don't know if that's part of everybody's, but, you know, that depression and just not feeling right with life. Because alcohol was my solution for a long time. And, you know, today it ain't. It ain't. It's, and, you know, I say I'm so blessed. I've known lots of people around here for lots and lots of years. They're great people. They've helped me tremendously. God, I know Roy and Dottie forever. I think maybe longer than forever. But you know, it's just an amazing thing. You know, one of the things I mentioned is when I was a kid. You know, we moved a lot. I went to different schools a lot, okay? And when I got older, that pattern continued. You know, looking at my job resume, I had lots of good jobs, but I had lots of them there. And until, you know, I finally got sober, and then I stuck with the place for a long, long time. And, you know, that's a whole different thing. It's like AA. I've got, you know, friends that I've had for 30 years, and you know, I never did anything for 3 years. I mean, it was, you know, I left some stuff out of, you know, the story, you know, like the spending a year in jail and then moving to Florida and stuff. But the general thing of it is here's a person, I lived in Cleveland, I lived in Buffalo, I lived in Vermont for 3 years, I lived in Fort Lauderdale. I mean, what a contrast, you know. Hey, I go where the snow's deep, and I go where it is. I mean, it's crazy, you know. It's just, but that's what I ended up doing. And, you know, now I've stuck in one spot. I mean, I've been down here a long, long time, and I love life. But geographical cures were just part of my thing, man. It was just another thing, and I had all kinds of things, you know. All kinds of ways where I would distract myself and say, this will be different, you know, maybe it's this job, maybe it's this city, maybe it's this wife, you know. I'm married to the same lady for over 25 years. I met her over at Sober at Six, you know, and, you know, we got a happy marriage. It's, you know, it's, life just keeps getting better and better and better as long as I'm willing to, do what it suggests to me. But I really appreciate you asking me to share. Thank you.